Today on The World, Iran says it's now enriching uranium at a higher level, nowhere near nuclear weapons grade, but British diplomats are concerned other steps could follow.
So even though these steps are incremental, they start to unwind all the protections that were put in place. They take Iran incrementally further towards the path of a nuclear weapon.
I'm Marco Werman. Britain's view of the Iran nuclear threat, plus... The World Cup is over, but the fight for equal pay is not. Also, a contrarian's take on Sweden's new smoking ban.
Having a cigarette and a beer, well, that might kill you eventually. But I think you have to live as well.
That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's Monday. Glad you could make it today. Well, they said it would happen, and now Iran's leaders have made it official. Iran is now enriching uranium at a higher level than is permitted under the 2015 nuclear deal, the same deal President Trump quit. Iran is still far from being able to produce a nuclear weapon, but it is one step closer to that now. Today's announcement adds to the stress on the European nations that still support the deal, which includes the UK. Karen Pierce is the British ambassador to the United Nations.
We're very concerned by the breach of the nuclear deal. At the same time, if there is an opportunity to return Iran to compliance and keep the nuclear deal in place, then given the importance of that for non-proliferation reasons, we'd like to take that opportunity. So we will be talking within the Atomic Energy Authority, who now need to verify exactly what Iran has done, and we will be taking stock of that and talking to the other participants in the nuclear deal, principally the French and Germans, and working out if we believe there is a possible route back to compliance for Iran.
Regardless of what the IAEA says, Tehran would seem to be saying the nuclear deal is dead. Isn't that the new reality today?
Well, the Iranians, I think, are determined to do what they're doing in an incremental fashion. So I don't think they have fully closed the door. But you're right, we need to look at exactly what they're saying. We need to assess what it means. If there is an opportunity to keep the nuclear deal in place, then that's something we will want to investigate.
Washington seems to have brought this problem upon itself by pulling out of the deal. We have to say that. Do you find that frustrating?
It's no secret that we disagreed with the American decision to pull out of the nuclear deal. So, yes, we believe that although there are many problems in the region that Iran contributes to by being a destabilizing influence, we believe that those issues are easier to tackle if Iran remains in the nuclear deal and doesn't acquire nuclear weapons.
And what do you tell Iranian diplomats in private? I imagine you're not going to share with us exactly what you say, but what is the gist?
You're quite right. We prefer to observe diplomatic confidences. We have always made clear to Iran that we recognize she has legitimate security interests. And we have made clear to Iran that we respect Iran as a country. She has a very ancient history, very distinguished history. We would like to have a different sort of relationship with Iran. We would like to see Iran playing a full and mature role in regional security. But these activities that Iran engages in make that a very hard aim to achieve.
So finally, I can't imagine, Ambassador Pierce, the last 24 hours have been quiet for you. I'm referring, of course, to the fallout after leaked diplomatic cables published yesterday. They reveal the UK ambassador to the US, Kim Darroch, describing the Trump administration as diplomatically clumsy and inept. I don't expect you're willing to comment on the cables themselves, but what is it like for you to conduct diplomacy right now when the leadership of the US and the UK are so much in turmoil?
You're right, Mark. I can't comment on leaked documents. You know, obviously, government documents shouldn't be leaked. And equally, obviously, diplomats around the world make candid assessments, which they share with their own governments of their hosts. So I won't comment on that. Kim Darroch is a good friend. He's an excellent diplomat. Here at the UN, we have been going about business as usual. This morning, we were talking about UN reform, and there will be a debate on counterterrorism in the Security Council tomorrow. I've seen the US diplomats here this morning, and everything was as normal and very friendly.
In the background, though, even before this news about these leaks, I mean, the alliances that have held the world together in recent decades, they seem to be coming unstuck. Are you tossing and turning a lot?
Things are not coming unstuck so much as a different sort of evaluation is being made by certain countries as to whether to put short-term national interests first rather than, as might have happened, say, 15 years ago, the predominant interests of a strategic alliance to which they belong. And I think this is all about how multilateralism is under threat at the moment. It's under threat from a lot of things, including populism. And one part of this, of course, is solidifying, bolstering the institutions that we set up after the Second World War, where the US was very instrumental in setting up the UN itself, setting up the non-proliferation regimes. And I think it is important to bolster those. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that the world looks very different from 1946. And we need to be much better, I think, at modernizing these institutions so that they're also more representative of the fact that there are now many more countries on the world stage than was the case 70 years ago.
Is there anything interfering with your sleep as the UK ambassador to the UN?
Oh, lots of things interfere with my sleep. Quite often the traffic from FDR. But, you know, it's such a privilege to be here. And the reason it interferes with my sleep is because I sleep with my curtains and windows open so I can see the sunrise. I face east. So that's a bonus.
You've got no fears right now.
Well, I have some, but I think probably I shall keep them to myself and I'll work them out quietly with our partners and friends, which include the United States and New York.
Karen Pierce, the UK's ambassador to the UN. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Today, one of those American partners had a message for Iran. Vice President Mike Pence said, quote, "Iran should not confuse American restraint with a lack of American resolve." Remember, it was last month when President Trump called off a planned U.S. military strike against Iran just minutes before it was scheduled. That was after the Iranians shot down a U.S. drone. Pence was speaking today to a pro-Israel Christian organization. Israel has been a big supporter of the Trump administration's maximum pressure campaign on Iran. But as the world's Matthew Bell reports, many in Israel are wondering what happens now.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has long been focused like a laser beam on Iran's nuclear activities. And over the years, he sent the message again and again.
I repeat. Israel will not allow Iran to develop nuclear weapons that threaten our existence and endanger the entire world.
The Israelis have shown they're willing to take preemptive military action if they see a nuclear threat. In 1981, Israeli jets destroyed a nuclear reactor in Iraq. In 2007, they bombed a suspected nuclear site in Syria. When Iran made its announcement this weekend that it was increasing its level of uranium enrichment, Netanyahu had this to say. This is a very, very dangerous step, the prime minister said. And he went on to ask the Europeans why they are not yet imposing new sanctions on Iran. Netanyahu was a fierce critic of the Iran nuclear agreement from the start. He applauded President Trump's decision to quit the deal in 2018. But that's not the whole story, says Ehud Eran from the University of Haifa in Israel.
If you take a more nuanced look, Israel does not speak in one voice. The prime minister was indeed very vocal against the deal, and I suspect was involved in affecting the president in deciding to pull out. At the same time, Israel's defense establishment, that is very dominant in the decision-making process, accepted it.
He says many Israeli leaders did not celebrate the Iran deal, but they learned to live with it and even see some benefits.
In fact, the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, even sort of rearranged its budget in the last few years away from Iranian-related issues.
But now that the Iran nuclear deal might be falling apart once and for all, the Israeli security establishment is faced with a new worry. Ehud Eran says that's because it's so unclear what the Trump administration is planning for Iran and its proxy forces in the region, most importantly, Hezbollah in Lebanon.
For Israelis, this is not a far away issue. Hezbollah has over 100,000 rockets directed at Israel. And there is a concern here that if there's further escalation with Iran, we may end up paying the price.
Hezbollah is not just the dominant force in Lebanon. Its fighters have also been active in the Syrian civil war. And the Israelis have been conducting airstrikes there to prevent the Iranian-backed militia from establishing itself in Syria. That's from a video of an alleged Israeli airstrike last week outside of the Syrian capital. The following day, the head of the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, gave a rare public speech. Yossi Cohen laid out his agency's view of the regional threats faced by Israel. He talked about Iran and its nuclear program, but Cohen spent just as much time addressing Iran's support for Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria. Here he is speaking through an interpreter.
We cannot allow Syria to become a logistic base for the transfer of armaments to Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Among the Israeli public, left, right, and center, there is strong support for Israel's military campaign against Iranian-backed forces in Syria. Meir Javadanfar is an Iranian-born Israeli security analyst.
This country is made up of a great number of Holocaust survivors and their children. And when the Iranian regime makes cartoon competitions ridiculing the Holocaust, people have no patience. So as far as many Israelis are concerned, anybody who's willing to confront this regime in any way, they would back him.
Like many Israelis, Javadanfar says he sees the Iran nuclear deal as flawed. But Trump's decision to quit the deal has created new uncertainty, and that makes Israelis nervous. It's probably a mistake to assume that Israel is looking for a way to start a military conflict with Iran. For all of his hawkish rhetoric, even Benjamin Netanyahu is wary about that possibility. Ehud Eran from the University of Haifa says there are some big political and personal constraints on the prime minister.
Elections coming in September 17th, 3 indictments, and his general tendency, which is completely contrary to his public image, to be very, very careful with any military action. Like all politicians, he realizes a war can come with a political price tag.
The Israelis will continue to ask themselves this question: how far is Iran from getting the bomb if it decides to race toward the nuclear finish line? Experts say the 2015 nuclear deal pushed Iran's breakout time from a couple of months to a full year. Iran's recent move on uranium enrichment does not change that timeline much. But today, Iran threatened to boost enrichment even further. For now, international inspectors are still in Iran, and the Europeans are looking for a way to keep the nuclear deal in place. For The World, I'm Matthew Pell.
You know the Puppy Bowl, the halftime show during the Super Bowl when adorable puppies bumble into each other? It's a lovable canine approximation of American football. Nah, it's just cute. Well, soccer fans, take heart. We bring you the Robot World Cup. Robo Cup. Not as cuddly as puppies, but endearing all the same.
This is Jack, a kid-sized robot from Germany.
This is Robodinho, a mid-sized robot from the Netherlands.
This is Walker Robot number one. It's an adult-sized robot, and it's from China.
Three robot handlers at RoboCup 2019 in Sydney, Australia, introducing their soccer-playing robots. The players are kitted out in soccer jerseys with numbers on their backs. Their movements are not swift or athletic, but they are improving their soccer skills over time.
What you saw a few years back is that robots that were good at shooting only or passing only, that was enough. But now you need to combine all those things together in a good strategy and make sure the robots work together.
Also exactly knowing where you are on a field, because the fields look exactly symmetric. So sometimes knowing if this is your own goal or the opponent's goal can be a bit hard.
All right, some work still needs to be done. The RoboCup attracts young programmers, engineers, and software developers from across the globe. They compete to perfect the movements and strategies of their autonomous soccer-playing robots.
They have to play fully autonomous, meaning they have to do everything on their own. Jack has quite advanced algorithms, for example, to find a ball on the field. He has to walk autonomously as well, of course, also knowing where he is on the field, and then he can score goals.
RoboCup organizers say that by 2050, they want robots to be able to play and beat the best human team in the world. And you know what? They can have the AstroTurf. More stories about robots and also about the World Cup ahead this hour. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Federal prosecutors in New York today charged Jeffrey Epstein with sex trafficking.
Beginning in at least 2002 and continuing until 2005, Epstein is alleged to have abused dozens of victims.
Epstein is a multimillionaire former hedge fund manager whose friends have included Donald Trump and Bill Clinton. Most of the news coverage around this case has focused on the way Epstein found his underage victims by paying some of the girls he abused to recruit other girls they met at house parties or the mall. But Epstein also allegedly found victims through a man named Jean-Luc Brunel. He's a modeling scout from France who's accused of bringing girls overseas to the U.S. under the pretense of getting them modeling contracts. Brunel has denied the claims. Anita Tika is a senior director of the anti-trafficking program at Safe Horizon. Do you find this unusual? Like, have you seen sex traffickers posing as modeling scouts before, or modeling scouts doing things that you thought counted as sex trafficking?
We have had clients who were enticed through modeling recruiters, and either they had a lot of exploitation and trafficking within the modeling industry as models, or they were sex trafficked after thinking they were going to enter into the modeling industry.
And how common is this kind of deal?
We don't have hard numbers on how many individuals are currently being trafficked or exploited within the modeling industry. A lot of human trafficking individuals don't self-identify as human trafficking individuals because they don't know that what they're experiencing is actually human trafficking. And so this can be in the form of being trafficked and forced to provide labor as a model, or to be forced to engage in commercial sexual activity.
If you're recruited, though, to model, how are you then forced to model?
So, for example, you might find that if you were told you would have 8-hour workdays and you would have rest periods and you would earn, say, $1,000 a week, you might find that you're asked to work 16 to 18 hours a day. You don't earn the amount that you were told you would earn, and you're not given adequate food or other nutrients in order to survive. And so the working conditions that you're promised versus what you're actually presented with once you engage in the work can be two very, very different things.
Got it. What part of the world do these victims tend to be from?
So it really depends, but it tends to be Eastern Europe or Mexico, Central America.
How do the sex traffickers actually find their victims?
It can be any number of ways now with online internet recruiting. And so if you put up a website and you have ads saying we are hiring for models and the pay would be this much and you get to travel internationally and you would make this much money that you can send home to support your family, that's clearly very enticing, especially for individuals who are coming from a more economically unstable background. For the sex traffic clients that we have, a lot of times they can be recruited through the guise of romantic relationships. And so once there is a sufficiently deep emotional attachment, then the trafficker will say, okay, well, actually, I need you to do a favor for me. I need you to do this modeling contract. You can earn some money. That would really help me out. That would help your family out. And so the individual will agree to do whatever the person is asking them to do. And then they find out that it's really something very different, that it might turn out to be a sex trafficking situation.
You know, the modeling industry seems like it lends itself to this in a big way. You've got young women detached from their parents, flying far away. Is this industry prone to this kind of thing? And what are they doing about it?
It depends on what the legal framework requires. So if we're talking about the United States, state by state, they may have their own legal requirements to ensure that there is no labor exploitation and trafficking of models in the industry. If the models are being taken from country to country, then it depends on that particular modeling agency and whether they are beholden to particular country guidelines as you're moving from Paris to Milan and so on. But within the fashion industry overall, we've seen trafficking and we've seen exploitation. We see it in the apparel industry with the making of garments. We see it in modeling. We see it in the picking of cotton to the creation of the thread and the silk to sewing the t-shirts. And so the more people you have involved, the more opaque it becomes to see who is doing what, who is responsible for what, and where does the ultimate liability lie.
Anita Tika with the anti-trafficking program, A Safe Horizon. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
There's an archaeological dig getting underway at one of Europe's most important battlefields, Waterloo in Belgium. That's where the French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte was finally defeated in 1815 at the hands of the British and their allies. The archaeological team includes 24 British and Dutch modern-day military veterans who are using the experience to help with their post-traumatic stress disorder. Mark Evans is a former British Army officer and Afghanistan veteran who co-founded the Waterloo Uncovered organization in 2015.
I mean, Waterloo Uncovered, I think, has helped me in the fact that I've been very lucky to be able to work with a lot of my former comrades and been able to, you know, help them in the recoveries. You know, when I got involved in it, I was lucky enough to be a little bit sort of further down the line than some of the guys that we have out with us. Archaeology that we do here allows them an opportunity to be involved in a project with a clear purpose. Because it's a military battlefield that we're excavating, actually, the information and the knowledge that they bring to the project is really, really helpful. I mean, archaeologists are really good at archaeology, but the veterans bring this sort of military information that adds and helps out with interpretation. On top of that, you know, wherever you're outside, you're working in teams, and all these kind of things that are really good for your sort of health, self-esteem, and your well-being. And for a lot of the guys who come on the project, these are things that they've lost, whether it's through injury or illness, or in most cases through leaving the army, and that's feeling, having that sort of sense that they've lost loss of purpose, loss of support. So coming back out on a project like this is a really important way, an effective way to reinvigorate them. And a lot of guys who come out here often say it was a real turning point, an opportunity for them to feel like they were the person that they used to know.
I mean, in terms of post-traumatic stress disorder, is there something in particular with the work you're doing, you know, digging up a past battlefield that does help veterans perhaps with PTSD?
In my own experience of PTSD, talking about these things is one of the most important things in helping you get through it. However, sometimes people find themselves in situations where they're going through therapy, and they can find the sort of traditional therapy quite confrontational, because you're dealing directly with issues and sort of hard work. So there is definitely something there with what we're doing, that having veterans, having them talking about a battle a long time ago, talking about the things that happened to other people a long time ago, allows them to actually talk about their own experiences in a sort of in a positive and interesting fashion and in a non-direct way, which is definitely beneficial.
So any new soldier is taught about the past glories of their new unit. You served in the Coldstream Guards. One of your regiment's most famous actions was at Waterloo. What do words like glory and honor mean to you today?
In the context of my own military experiences?
Yeah.
I think of war as not necessarily being quite as glorious as I did when I was a younger man. War to me, I think sadly it's still necessary, and I'm still very glad that there are other people out there who take on that responsibility, you know, on my behalf. I like to think there may be a day where it isn't necessary. What's really interesting about what we do, you know, we're studying a battle, we're using war in a positive way to try and help people and also try and educate people about what it's like to be in the military and what it's like to go to war, and the realities of it. So it's not just the good, but also the bad.
Mark Evans is a former British Army officer and Afghanistan veteran. He's been speaking with us from Waterloo. Thanks for your service, Mark, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to The World. President Rodrigo Duterte's war on drugs has reportedly left thousands dead in the Philippines. Amnesty International says there's a better way.
What we would like to tell the Philippine government and the Philippines people is that the Philippines can fight drugs effectively without murdering suspected drug offenders.
I'm Marco Werman. That story ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. You might have heard this over the weekend.
Equal pay! Equal pay! Equal pay!
Thousands of fans chanting equal pay at the end of the Women's World Cup final in Lyon, France. The U.S. team won, as I'm sure you know, the same team that just 4 months ago brought a lawsuit alleging gender discrimination in pay. Fans worldwide have now joined the cause. Stephanie Yang has been covering the World Cup for SB Nation and joins us from Paris. My first question is about the movement for equal pay, Stephanie. Gender discrimination and pay, I mean, it's been true in soccer for some time, right? But how did the money question get so big now with national teams and fans?
I think it's a confluence of a lot of different things. It certainly helps that the United States is a very visible team with several players who are extremely vocal.
As far as what this cup represented money-wise, FIFA, the international governing body for soccer, awarded $30 million in prize money to all the competing teams in the Women's World Cup. But that's far less than what men's teams get. I mean, that's like $440 million, as I understand. And yet it's far more than what women's teams have gotten in the past.
Why are these differences so vast?
Men's soccer's had a heck of a jump on women's soccer because men's soccer has operated continuously for, 100 plus years, whereas women's soccer was only sanctioned by FIFA starting in the late 70s, I want to say. And before then, it was banned in several countries. And FIFA just didn't pay any attention to it. They left it fallow for a really long time. So if one business has like an 80-year head start on the other, of course it's going to be making more money.
And if I were to ask, why didn't FIFA kind of like, once it became clear that women's soccer is a thing, why didn't they just make things equitable?
I think because they're already making money hand over fist with the men.
So a simple but insensitive business decision?
Yeah, with a healthy dash of actual misogyny.
If we were to follow the money with this Women's World Cup, do players get all the prize money?
I don't think players get all the money. So the money technically goes to the federation, who's then going to disperse that amongst the players. And I don't think they literally get all of the prize money, which is why federations want to be part of the World Cup, at least on the men's side, because there's prize money to be had. Even if you don't win the whole thing, there's, tiers of awards. So if you can make it and, even in the group stage, you're going to get a nice little chunk of change for your federation, and it doesn't all get passed on to the players.
So, like, how do salaries vary per national team with the Women's World Cup? Like, just because the U.S. got the most prize money, does that mean the players earn the most?
I would say the U.S. women's team earns the most just because they've kind of been in the game the longest. The New York Times did a really great piece where they talked to a lot of different players around the world about average salaries. And so you can have a player making $350,000 a year in the United States with like bonus money. And you can have a player from Argentina making $3,000 a year, $800 a month, something like that. So the disparity is huge.
And then there's all the commercial revenue. How is that distributed?
We don't know. We just don't know. A lot of the talk about the women's equal pay dispute has come from, well, break down how much money you spend on the women and what the return on investment there is. And U.S. Soccer will say, well, we bundled the rights, the TV rights or stuff like that. So we can't give you an exact breakdown of like what percentage went to the women and what percentage went to the men. So we can obviously track things like ticket sales, merchandise sales. But in terms of like marketing, commercial revenue, U.S. Soccer is like, well, we bundled it. So we can't, or they won't tell us. And I think FIFA is the same way.
Were there any memorable moments or even signs people were holding that you saw during the tournament? And what impact do you think that had on the equal pay movement?
There was a girl at the final holding up a Watch the NWSL sign.
That refers to the National Women's Soccer League here in the U.S.
To the National Women's Soccer League. And, it kind of crystallized the crisis that we have every 4 years where we wonder, how can we translate the popularity and success of this international tournament into club growth, not just in the United States, but, England had a great run into knockout rounds. How are they going to translate that into the popularity of the WSL or Spain's women in their first division or the French women, in their league, which has probably one of the best teams in the world in Olympique Lyon, but it also has probably one of the most imbalanced leagues in the world in that Lyon is routinely blasting people out of the water, like 9, 10, 11 goals to nothing. So I thought that was a great moment to have us all question, like, okay, what next? Like, you don't put it in a closet and then you take it out 4 years later and it somehow has grown. You have to feed it.
Stephanie Yang, who's been covering the World Cup for SB Nation, speaking with us from Paris. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you.
The Philippines' so-called war on drugs is notorious for its violence against suspected drug dealers and even users. The government of President Rodrigo Duterte has been accused of extrajudicial killings in the effort to eradicate the drug trade. Now, Amnesty International has issued a report on the government's alleged abuses. It says the anti-drug campaign is so indiscriminate, it rises to the level of crimes against humanity, and it's calling on the international community to act. Rawia Rage is a senior crisis advisor for Amnesty. She's in New York. Who exactly is being targeted in these operations?
The police say that they target people who are allegedly involved in selling or using drugs. Our documentation indicates that the vast majority of the people who end up being killed belong to poor and marginalized communities. That is why we have repeatedly described this policy as a war on the poor. The vast majority of the families we speak to have been further impoverished by this policy. Families continue to sustain massive debt after the killings of their breadwinners. engineers and several local officials that we have spoken to and others indicate that those who continue to be targeted belong to these poor and marginalized community rather than quote-unquote big-time drug operators.
Rodrigo Duterte is scoring in approval ratings. In opinion polls, he's going into the 70 to 80% range. How do you account for that?
There's no denial that Rodrigo Duterte is a popular president. Amnesty International does recognize the risk that drugs can pose to individuals and societies, and obviously the obligation of governments to adopt adequate measures to protect their people from the harmful effects of drugs. What we would like to tell the Philippine government and the Philippines people is that the Philippines can fight drugs effectively without murdering suspected drug offenders at such a deliberate and systematic scale. States should aim to curb the negative impact of drugs through fair and non-discriminatory enforcement, and of course, more importantly, through adequate prevention campaigns and effective drug treatment. They should not be pursuing policies that violate human rights and are detrimental to public health.
Is anybody in Duterte's government listening to that advice?
Since the launch of the report earlier this morning, Manila Time, several Philippine government officials have reiterated their usual line of denying our findings and saying that anybody who has a case should be filing cases and that witnesses should come forward. To them, we would like to say that at the heart of the issue, at the heart of the problem is the difficulty, I would like to use the words of one of our interviewees, as if, quote unquote, as if it were so easy. We have been able to see the extent of the difficulties families face in bringing forward cases. There is an absolute palpable sense of fear of reprisal. Families are terrified to come forward. Witnesses are terrified to come forward. And it's not easy to file a case. To begin with, we were able to see how families struggle to obtain crucial documents such as police reports and autopsy reports needed to dispute the police's narrative and account.
So is the deal in the Philippines, the police might get a word or hint or a rumor of somebody dealing drugs and they just go out and they kill him? I mean, is it as blunt as that?
This policy does involve specific steps. It begins from the collection of so-called drug watch lists that are collected by local officials. And we were able to document once again in this report the immense pressure on local officials to collect these so-called watch lists that are not based in any legal process, but are entirely based on personal knowledge, rumor, and innuendo. And then these lists are submitted to the police. And what we see is that people on these drug watch lists, as well as others, then end up being targeted by the police and end up being arrested or, much worse, killed.
A number of countries have called on the UN to investigate the Philippines' war on drugs, Duterte's war on drugs. Do you support that effort? I mean, what else can be done?
As I've mentioned, we have documented in the past and we continue to document the deliberate and systematic natures of the killings and that they are part of a government-orchestrated attack against poor people suspected of using or selling drugs. That is why Amnesty International is calling on the international community, specifically through the Human Rights Council, to step in and initiate an investigation. Currently, there is a resolution at the Human Rights Council. It is an important first step. It does put the Philippines on the agenda of the Human Rights Council for the first time formally. And we would like to see support to this resolution because any other action would tacitly be supporting these unlawful killings.
Rauya Rage with Amnesty International in New York. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Japan has a demographic problem. A rapidly aging population means there are not enough young workers to power its economy. There are many ways Japan is trying to tackle this. One of them involves robots, as the BBC's Stephanie Hegarty reports from Tokyo.
Hi, I'm Erica. Nice to meet you.
You too.
Where are you from?
This small room down a winding corridor, high up in the Nippon TV tower, is where Erica Aoi lives. She's one of Nippon TV's newest stars, and the first robot TV presenter in the world.
Welcome to the BBC. I'm Erica Aoi. Today's news.
She's eerily perfect, with light, rubbery skin and shiny hair. And she's perched with impossibly good posture on a white leather armchair.
The president was promised a visit by...
Erica mines the internet to learn how to speak, but her conversation skills still need some work.
Tofu.
Tofu.
I like you.
I like tofu.
I can't eat it.
I'm not sure you can.
I can't either.
Okay, if you insist.
Koi Kawakami, her engineer, says it might be 50 years before Erica can chat like a human.
Wow, this is good.
Some people are worried about the idea of robots replacing us. On a list of humans that would be missed in a robot takeover, though, I'm not sure TV presenters would be too high up there. But would you let a robot look after your children? This is Vivo, a 3-foot-tall, shiny blue robot bear.
So aside from being super cute, Vivo also greets kids when they arrive and takes their temperature. He records how much they've had to eat and how much they've slept, and then he tells the parents that at the end of the day when they come to pick their kids up. Aside from that, at this point, he doesn't do much else.
Joe Sadamatsu set up this group of care homes and nurseries when he was in his 20s. Now it's a multi-million dollar business. But they have one major struggle.
We need more staff. Japan needs to take in more foreigners. Or we have to find more women to work. Or robots.
How long do you think it will be before the whole nursery is run by robots? 15! That's soon!
For the moment, though, Vivo is more of an idea than a revolution. But some robots are ready to shake up industries, like farming. We're about an hour outside Tokyo, and we've come to the leafy green seaside town of Kamakura. Just outside a traditional wooden Japanese house, there is a patch of dirt, and in that dirt, a small, miniature tank-like robot. It's called Inaho, and it's been developed to pick fruits and vegetables.
The robot has this special type of camera, so it will sort of observe the shape, the asparagus, and whether it's long enough so that it can be picked or not.
Shinpei Tobayama is one of Inaho's developers.
And it's projected that within the next 10 years, the number of Japanese farmers are going to decrease by half, actually.
The idea is that this machine will cost a little less than human labor. A robot designed to replace humans could also help smallhold farmers to survive. And robots can help people get back to work. I'm heading to meet someone in Ginza, a fancy part of Tokyo.
Hi,
hey, how are you?
But my date, Koki Yanagida, is 300 miles away.
Want to walk down this way?
He sent his avatar, a robot called Orihime. It's about the size of a doll, with a round white body, big green eyes, and disc-shaped arms that can wave adorably up and down.
When I was 17 years old, I dived into a swimming pool and I broke my neck. Since then, I have been paralyzed below my neck.
Through Orihime, we can wander down the high street of Ginza and even go to a sports car showroom.
Koki, why are you so interested in cars?
I used to like super cars.
Koki-san took part in a pilot project where he was able to work in a cafe for a day using a bigger version of Orihime.
I have another me, like a body double. I can go anywhere with Orihime.
Even in a place where workers are desperately needed, people are proving that even if robots could replace us, they don't have to.
That's the BBC's Stephanie Hegarty reporting there from Tokyo. This month, Sweden has taken a big step toward becoming a smoke-free country. Swedes recently prohibited smoking in playgrounds, railway stations, and the outdoor sections of restaurants and bars. Smoking inside public establishments had already been banned. The goal is for the country to be completely smoke-free by 2025. Niklas Kvarnström is against that. He lives in Stockholm, and as we were starting to talk, I heard a flicking sound. Did you just light up?
Yeah, I did.
I thought I heard a cigarette lighter.
Yeah.
How much do you smoke a day?
I don't know, like maybe a 20.
So perhaps an understatement here. Kvarnström is a smoker. He also started a Facebook group to protest the new smoking ban.
Well, I have no problem with a smoking ban in playgrounds and train stations. My problem is that you're not allowed to have a cigarette outside your bar or cafe. Especially, I mean, in nighttime, we're all adults and we have a very strict alcohol policy in Sweden as well. So there won't be any children or minors being affected by it anyway. So I think they took it a little bit too far.
Yeah, so you feel the attitude has gotten too repressive now?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Smoking has been banned in bars and restaurants in Sweden since 2005. Do you agree, or did you agree with that restriction when it came in?
Well, no, I didn't. It's a very repressive law. Maybe it would be up to the bar owners or the cafe owners or restaurant owners. It's a consensual thing. I mean, you enter a restaurant where people are smoking. If you're not a smoker and you don't enjoy smoking, well, then you go somewhere else. I don't see the benefits of a total ban.
But that implies that it's the non-smokers who have to change their attitudes, not the smokers.
Well, I get your point, Marco. But still, I think that there are so many non-smokers that want to be in smoke-free environments. So a lot of restaurants, they would like to have smoke-free restaurants anyway. In Denmark, for example, there are restaurants still, not restaurants, but bars, small bars, where you can smoke. And nobody who doesn't like cigarette smoke would go in there anyway. The majority of places are still smoke-free, so I don't really see the point in banning all of them. No.
I mean, most people feel that it is a government's job to champion a healthy nation and try and counter things that are bad for your health. It's clear that smoking is a dangerous health risk, and the Swedish government seems to be taking that pretty seriously in this kind of smoke-free nation goal by 2025. What is wrong with that approach?
There's nothing wrong with wanting your citizens to be healthy, but there are a lot of things that are not healthy, and you can't really just think about that all the time. You have to think about other qualities to life, and having a cigarette and a beer or a cup of coffee, well, that might kill you eventually. But I think it's also a lot of things are dangerous, and you have to live as well, and living will eventually kill you too. So
do you feel like the laws are judging people like you?
Yeah, I do. Also, people who are bothered by smoking, they will feel that now it's okay to sort of bash all smokers and let go of their hatred towards sort of, I don't know, less fit, less healthy people who sort of, I don't know, threaten the image of how society is supposed to look like.
I mean, the science is also judging smokers. I mean, cigarette smoking kills people.
Mm. Yeah, it does. Alcohol kills people too. And fewer people smoke these days, which is a good thing. And I think we could handle in Sweden, it's like 9% of the population that smokes.
How long have you been a smoker?
I think maybe since I was 15, 14, 15, something. I started quite early. And now I'm turning 50 this autumn. So, yeah, you do the maths.
Have you ever tried quitting?
Yeah, I did quit for like 10 months a couple of years ago.
Why didn't it take?
Yeah, that's a good question. I visited a friend in Denmark. We went to a bar where we were allowed to smoke, and I asked for a cigarette, and the next day I was back to smoking.
That was it.
Yeah.
I think your experience in Denmark is kind of instructive, because you went to a bar where they allowed smoking, and you had stopped, and then suddenly you're smoking again. So in a way, that kind of validates what your country, Sweden, is doing.
Yeah, for sure. But still, I don't want to live in a country that is so absolute or so repressive about it.
You'd leave your home country, Sweden, to smoke?
No, not really. But I go on what I call smoking vacations to countries where you're allowed to smoke. And I sit inside bars and smoke cigarettes.
What's the best country to smoke in these days? Like, if you had to go on vacation, where is that?
Here it's Serbia. I haven't been there yet.
Serbia.
But, yeah, I'm definitely going there.
You lit up just as we started this interview. You still working that cigarette?
No, I'm working my second, actually.
Okay. Niklas Kvarnström is Swedish. He's a writer, and he's against the new restrictions on smoking in public spaces that just took effect in Sweden. Thank you for your time, Niklas.
Well, thank you too, Marco.
We learned on Saturday that bossa nova pioneer João Gilberto died at the age of 88.
Olha que coisa mais linda, mais cheia de graça. Ela, menina que vem, que passa.
João Gilberto's fame outside of Brazil had a lot to do with this recording from 1964. The Girl from Ipanema, of course. Stan Getz on sax, João Gilberto on guitar and voice. Enunciation you could learn a language by. His touch on the guitar insisted you pay attention. The woman's voice, by the way, belongs to Astrid Gilberto, João's wife at the time.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes, ah.
João Gilberto did not write The Girl from Ipanema himself, but you could say he paved the way for that song in the 1950s when he wrote and released this track called Bim Bom.
Bing bong, bing bing bong, bing bong, bing bing bong, bing bong.
Another Brazilian musician, Antonio Carlos Jobim, heard Bim Bom, loved it, and wound up as one of João Gilberto's main collaborators. It was Jobim who wrote The Girl from Ipanema and most of the other songs on the famous Gets Gilberto album, and he wrote them with João's guitar in mind, a sound that some in Brazil called violão gago, or stammering guitar. Gilberto was essentially slowing down the beat of samba, making his guitar sound off-kilter in a hip way. That was in Jobim's head when he wrote Chega de Saudade for Gilberto's guitar, making it the first bossa nova hit in Brazil, even before Gets Gilberto won over the rest of the world. Listen to how the flute and Gilberto's guitar almost work against each other in the song's intro. That is bossa nova.
Vá, minha tristeza, e diz a ela que sem ela não pode ser. Diz-lhe numa prece que ela regresse, porque eu não posso mais sofrer. Chega de saudade a realidade.
João Gilberto, a lot of people are missing you, but we'll always have your stammering guitar. Our theme music is by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.